This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Good to be with you on this February afternoon. Yep, still February, although Mother Nature apparently thinks it's April. I know it's a lovely warm day outside, but stay with us for the next half hour as we go on a country road trip with a pair of conservationists who make it their mission to trap and band as many American kestrels as they can. We'll also have a report on the tension between human development and long-term conservation efforts. And later on, our weekly review of what the General Assembly in Richmond has been up to. But first, protests against President Trump's agenda continued in Charlottesville last week, including a rally at the office of 5th District Republican Congressman Tom Garrett, who says he supports repeal of the Affordable Care Act. WMRA's Jordy Yeager and NPR's Sarah McCammon were both there. We'll begin with Jordy's report.
More than 100 people showed up to Republican Congressman Tom Garrett's office shortly after noon on Tuesday.
So let's be clear, because their intentions are clear. They want to give tax cuts to the rich and take health care from the poor, and we are here to say no.
Indivisible Charlottesville launched 10 days ago with demands that Garrett withdraw his support of President Trump's recent executive orders affecting refugees and immigrants. A week ago, it marched on Garrett's office protesting GOP efforts to dismantle the Affordable Health Care Act. On Tuesday, it did so again.
We are not going back to the days when vulnerable populations sat for hours in overcrowded emergency rooms because it's the only place that they could get health care. No way.
In small groups, protesters filed into Garrett's second floor office. They were welcomed by his staff.
Hello.
Not everyone on Tuesday was opposed to Garrett. In a back office with a dozen pizzas and a case of bottled water, area resident Connie Stevens and a friend showed up to support Garrett and Trump.
They're going to make things great. They're keeping us safe. They're going to build the wall. They're going to free up the market for health care. We're going to get better health care. Everything's going great. So I'm happy.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
NPR's Sarah McCammon was also at that protest and has more on Larry Stopper's work with the group near Charlottesville, as well as a wider view of the thousands of Indivisible chapters that have suddenly popped up around the nation, including about three dozen in Virginia, in opposition to the Trump agenda.
Larry Stopper retired in August after decades as a small business owner. But for the last several weeks, he's been busy.
I started organizing from my living room, just sending out an email to the people on my list. 41 years, I have a lot of contacts in the county.
That's Nelson County, outside Charlottesville, Virginia, a county President Obama won twice before Trump turned it red. Stopper leads a local chapter of a group called Indivisible, which is organizing protests and other political actions designed to pressure Congress and the Trump administration. Anne Ashton, a retired teacher who lives in the county, says she had to find an outlet for her concern.
I'm afraid we were going right down the road to a dictatorship. I mean, he's already attacking the free press. I mean, he's been doing that for a long time, and it seems like they are attacking, he and his group are attacking anything that has to do with freedom and free speech.
Over the lunch hour yesterday, the Nelson County group joined the Indivisible Charlottesville chapter to march a couple of blocks through town to Republican Congressman Tom Garrett's office, where Stopper rallied the group.
And we are indivisible!
Activists took turns going inside to talk to Garrett's staff, expressing opposition to Trump's travel restrictions and support for the Affordable Care Act. Across the country, Indivisible groups are reaching out to their members of Congress. Rebecca Nowaczek is an English professor from the Milwaukee area.
I didn't know where my representatives' offices were before. I didn't know the names of the staffers there who I might talk to. So it's not a new strategy, but I think for a lot of people, it's new to them.
The approach isn't new, says Ezra Levin, a former Democratic congressional staffer who co-authored the Indivisible Guide, a strategy manual that's available online for free.
We had been on Capitol Hill during the rise of the Tea Party.
Levin says Tea Party Republicans were able to slow down and sometimes stop key components of President Obama's agenda.
And we thought, hey, this can work for us right now.
In an interview on Fox, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer described the Tea Party as organic and suggested that anti-Trump protesters are being paid. Activist Larry Stopper mocks that idea, joking to the crowd that if a liberal benefactor is cutting checks, his hasn't arrived.
So if anybody out there is in touch with George Soros, would they let him know that I'm not getting my paycheck.
And to Trump supporters who say it's time to move on now that Trump is president, Stopper says this is his way of moving on.
We have gotten over it. He is the president. We aren't disagreeing that he, in fact, is the president. But he has an agenda, and we have an agenda.
And Stopper says activists will work just as hard as President Trump to promote their agenda and push back against his. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Charlottesville, Virginia.
Let's get away from politics for a little bit and talk about wildlife conservation. The American kestrel is North America's smallest falcon. And across Virginia and other states, efforts are underway to study and save this raptor. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz accompanied one couple whose kestrel nesting boxes dot the countryside of northern Rockingham County.
Okay, all the traps are ready.
As Lance Morrow pulls into the gravel driveway of a construction company warehouse along a country road through rolling hay and pastureland, his wife and licensed master bander Jill prepares small cages, a white mouse in each.
Male kestrel.
Where is he?
They're trapping American kestrels, colorful 4-ounce falcons that often perch on power lines watching for mice and other prey. The national population decline of these birds over the last 45 years is estimated at 47%. In the Northeast, that could be as high as 88%, a suspected casualty of their grasslands habitat loss due to human development, agricultural practices, and because these predators prefer open fields for hunting, abandoned farmland becoming forested.
Okay, so we threw three traps.
There he is.
Each cage Lance throws out the truck window is laced with fishing line nooses that will snag the hungry falcon's toes.
Let me verify his male.
See him right here on the wire, about 40 yards away.
So we're just going to watch to see if he goes after the traps.
The two Morrows will band previously uncaught birds or learn about the health and habits of the local population from one of the 1,200 they've already banded.
It's really warm today, so they're going to be eating worms and might be a little difficult to trap.
The Morrows are retired independent contractors and conservationists who for the last 2 years have been working full-time to analyze and publish papers from their decades of collecting wildlife data from here and elsewhere. They are also continuing to study kestrels in their Shenandoah Valley Raptor Study Area, 144 square miles surrounding Timberville.
No, he's flying away.
He says, no, I'm not interested.
They started in 2008 with 6 kestrel nesting boxes. They now have 90. Aside from about 10 taken over by squirrels, the Morrows say their boxes have an occupancy rate of 85 to 95%.
Oh, we'll pick up.
So we're going to try for one that's more hungry.
Right or left?
The birds in the Morrows' study overall don't seem to be migrating or even moving out of the study area.
That's part of the study that we weren't even expecting. It's like we have a self-contained population of kestrels and very little flow of genetics. After 1,200 birds banded, we're not having any reported being trapped or found dead north of us in Pennsylvania or south of us. All of our birds appear to be just right here.
And we've never caught anybody else's banded kestrel.
They think that climate change could be one factor that's affecting the migratory habits of kestrels.
You know, in the olden days, I'm sure kestrels from up north flew here and found it a good place to winter. We don't have anybody's birds from the north coming here now.
Later in the morning, along another country road, the Morrows spot several more kestrels and wait to see if any respond to the 3 traps they've just placed.
I think if he could go down and try to catch one of those mice and prove to his wife how good he is at providing provisions, he's gone.
I think he's on... Okay, stop. Let me look at the traps.
Do you see 3?
Yeah, we got somebody. Let's go.
Jill retrieves the female kestrel looped to a trap, and they examine and band the bird.
That's all there is to it. Isn't she lovely? It will be very interesting to see if we catch her in that box right behind me come this breeding season.
And then it's time to set the kestrel free.
When we tell you, you're going to 1, 2, 3, and you're just going to go like this.
They let an accompanying youngster along for the morning release it.
Count out loud.
1, 2, 3. Oh.
and it flies up to perch on the power line over its roadside habitat between a heavily grazed pasture and cornfield stubble.
Was that cool or was that cool?
Cool!
In a follow-up report, Christopher explores the balancing act between human development and wildlife and asks about the long view.
Lance and Jill Morrow know that for the wildlife in their Shenandoah Valley Raptor Study Area and elsewhere, survival in the face of great human-caused odds is a sort of death sentence dodge.
A hawk can't fly across the field without being cut in half by a barbed wire fence. Can't land on a pole without being electrocuted. All his habitat is on the sides of the county roads and the major highways, and he can't fly and catch a mouse without being hit by a car.
A root of the problem, he says, is that people don't see economic value in wildlife. Sure, the American kestrels he and Jill study do kill and eat lots of mice, which farmers appreciate. However, Lance has a bit of a pessimistic streak.
Bird watchers like to see the little falcon, and that's as far as it goes, as far as I can tell.
Do you think they're valueless?
Yeah, everything is valueless, right? Or we take care of it, right?
Morrow thinks that when it comes to the natural world in which we live, and which we often endanger, people should be thinking longer term.
Everyone's thinking about the local economy in the minute. What this area, every place in the world, needs is what I call a 500-year plan. And that is, what do you want the Shenandoah Valley to look like 500 years from now?
I suspected that Morrow's 500-year plan idea was not very mainstream.
Generally, planning at the local level is done looking out 25 to 50 years.
Rhonda Cooper is the director of planning in Rockingham County's Department of Community Development. She says that the county is working to control growth in ways that will both preserve rural areas and promote development.
It's important to have urban growth area boundaries around the towns and the city and not let that development sprawl out and start to impact your rural areas.
But just protecting a rural lifestyle or land for agriculture from overdevelopment doesn't necessarily translate to better wildlife habitat. Diane Lepkowski, Rockingham County's Deputy Zoning Administrator and Deputy Subdivision Agent, is the Vice President of Rockingham Bird Club, which has supported the Morrow's work.
Obviously, the suburban lawn is not going to be a kestrel habitat, but a lot of farmland and open rural land is not kestrel habitat either. A cornfield is like a barren wasteland for a kestrel.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to where we're going to be in 500 years. Good question, though.
I took the 500-year plan idea to the state, to Tom Smith, Deputy Director of Operations for the Virginia Department of Conservation and Recreation.
I think, you know, the natural resources budget is less than 1% of the state budget. We certainly value conservation, and we, you know, devotes a limited number of state resources toward it.
15% of the land in Virginia is made up of the state park system, federally owned land such as national parks, about 56,000 acres of natural area preserves, and about 1 million acres of land in other kinds of easements. Such easements might be the longest-term conservation option for landowners, at least those whose localities put up local money to buy property development rights with matching funds from the Office of Farmland Preservation in the Virginia Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. That program is managed by Andrew Sorrell.
The primary way to permanently preserve land is through a permanent conservation easement. Permanent means perpetual, so it means forever. In essence, that could be 500 years, however many years perpetual is.
Those easements can have a variety of purposes, from preserving standing woodland, wildlife habitats, historic resources, and even active farmland, says Sorrell, and it's purposefully difficult to change their terms. Again, Rockingham County's Diane Lepkowski.
A lot of the environmental impact and supporting wildlife really is, it falls on the individual landowners if that's something that's important to them or not on their radar at all.
And that's part of what Lance and Jill Morrow do in their raptor study area. Show the birds to curious people. In the olden days, Lance says,
you would go to your robin nest and you'd steal a baby robin and try to feed it and it would die. Then you try it again and maybe it will survive. And the neighbors, when an imprint robin flies to the neighbor's house and they know who it is and they take care of it too, everybody learns and it's a hands-on experience.
The current law disallows the unlicensed handling of birds and wildlife.
So everyone is disconnected from the wildlife, I guess the state wants to protect.
That's ironic, because, as Jill says,
it's hard to conserve something you don't have any clue about. You need to make a personal connection with wildlife.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
It was crossover week at the General Assembly in Richmond. That means lawmakers are more than halfway through the legislative session. For a roundup of the week's activity at the Capitol, Virginia Public Radio's Luke Church spoke with reporter Michael Pope.
So this is the week when all the House bills crossed over to the Senate and all the Senate bills crossed over to the House. Now, why is that significant?
Well, the chief significance is that there will be no new bills that will emerge this General Assembly session. Basically, everything that's going to happen has already emerged. And as you said, all the House members are now looking at the Senate bills and the senators are now looking at the House bills. You know, one thing that we're probably going to see a lot of is the governor pulling out his veto pen and vetoing things. Like, for example, the Republicans have passed legislation to defund abortion clinics, to crack down on sanctuary cities, to have public funding go to private schools, to require photo IDs for absentee ballots. These are all things that the governor is likely to veto at the end of the General Assembly session. So I asked Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam, a Democrat, about this particular phenomenon of awaiting the governor's veto pen, and this is how he responded.
You know, anything like that, anything that interferes with women's access to reproductive health care, the governor will veto, and I'm glad he will.
So what does that say about this session, that people are spending so much time and effort on stuff that is sort of ill-fated to begin with?
Well, it says that they need to focus on our economy. And that's what Governor McAuliffe and Attorney General Mark Herring and I have focused on, making sure that all Virginians have economic opportunity, no matter who they are, no matter where they are.
Now, Luke, as you might imagine, Republicans do not share that view. I talked to Republican Majority Leader Kirk Cox about the governor breaking out that veto pen, and he responded that the General Assembly has actually taken decisive steps way beyond anything the governor might veto. This is what he had to say about that.
I think if you look at the majority of things that we pass, they are bread and butter issues such as curtailing regulations, innovative stuff in higher ed like online new models, totally redoing financial aid. There are a handful of bills that probably deal with, you know, those types of issues. You see probably more bills coming from the other side of the aisle, obviously, on those types of issues.
Now, if that sounds like a stump speech, it's because it is. This is an election year. Virginia has those odd year elections. So all the members of the House of Delegates will be up for election and or re-election later this year.
Well, speaking of elections, one issue that was hotly debated this week is who gets to vote, right? I mean, what happened there?
Well, this is a very contentious issue that sort of centers around this idea of former felons. You may remember last year, the Governor McAuliffe had this very controversial move where he restored voting rights to hundreds of thousands of former felons. And the Republicans did not like that. And so now they're in the process of essentially taking power away from the governor and giving it to the legislature in terms of who gets to actually restore these voting rights. So there was a hotly debated Senate discussion about this week. And Senate Republican leader Tommy Norman took the floor and he talked about barriers to access to voters. This is what he had to say on the Senate floor.
That barrier already exists. That barrier exists because you broke the law. You broke the law. And that's what creates the barrier, not any Senate joint resolution.
So as you can see, this is an emotional debate on the Senate floor. And there's one aspect of this that's really interesting, which is that if the Senate passes this potential constitutional amendment, the governor doesn't get to veto it because it goes directly to the voters. Now, there's a few more steps because the General Assembly would have to pass the same thing again next year. But assuming that this gets out of the General Assembly this year and it gets out of the General Assembly again next year, the governor will not be able to veto it and it will go directly to voters.
Well, it does sound like there is a lot happening there in Richmond, Michael. And we thank you for joining us to give us an inside look into the General Assembly.
Thank you.
And lawmakers in Richmond weren't just debating among themselves. They also wrangled with the ghost of a state senator from more than 100 years ago. Michael Pope has this brief look at the skeletons in the closet at the Capitol.
Meet State Senator Carter Glass of Lynchburg. No, he's not currently serving in the General Assembly. He was there 100 years ago, and he's now infamous for creating the poll tax, in addition to the state constitution specifically designed to prevent blacks from voting. Fast forward more than 100 years, Senate Democratic leader Dick Sasslaw says a modern-day constitutional amendment on voting rights essentially reinstates the poll tax by preventing people who haven't paid court costs from voting.
It's kind of hard to deal with this topic without thinking about Carter Glass, because he put this thing straight in. He did this to keep the blacks from voting. No other reason. That was it. And he stated that.
Republican leader Tommy Norman rejects that comparison.
Don't invoke what happened in 1902 to try to stir up, you know, some emotions on this thing.
After a contentious debate on the history of racism in Virginia, senators narrowly approved a constitutional amendment that would remove the ability of the governor to restore voting rights to people who have not paid court costs. Lawmakers say they should be able to make that decision, not the governor. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
This is Our Island Universe. Alan Shepard was the first American in space. Dr. Sally Ride was the first American woman to fly into space. So who was the first African-American woman? Dr. Mae Jemison. She became the first African-American woman in space when she was part of the Space Shuttle Endeavour crew, September 12, 1992. As a young girl, Mae Carol Jemison always believed she would become an astronaut, but she also had many other interests. She wanted to become a professional dancer. So at the age of 16, when she was deciding whether to go to medical school or to become a professional dancer, her mom said, "You can always dance if you're a doctor, but you can't doctor if you're a dancer." She graduated in 1977 with her Bachelor of Science degree in chemical engineering. In 1981, she earned her Doctor of Medicine degree from Cornell Medical College. During that time, she took modern dance lessons at the Alvin Ailey School, and she produced several shows of modern jazz and African dance. In 1987, Mae was one of 15 candidates out of nearly 2,000 applicants that was accepted into the astronaut program. Dancer, chemical engineer, and medical doctor Mae Jemison was the first African-American woman launched into space and continues to be a pathfinder and role model for all Americans today.
I am Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Pam and Jim Huggins, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org. And be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.